She's been waiting for her court date all this time from home.
You know, ICE detention is in many ways unique in the complex of ways that we lock people up in the United States, in that it is routinely the case that people don't know how long they will be held. They don't know when they will be released. People can be held for many months and sometimes multiple years. And this is a detention system that is at the discretion of ICE. ICE can decide to hold people or not. Everybody who's in ICE detention could be released and allowed to be home with their families, and that's a decision that the government makes
every day.
We have
to leave it there, but you can see the documentary, The Facility, at MSNBC and Field of Vision. Seth Fried Wessler and Nielsen Barona, thank you. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
To listener supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
I dumb hole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
Join KBOO every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for Counterspin, a show that provides a critical examination of major media stories and exposes what the mainstream media missed. Counterspin exposes and highlights censored stories, sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, the power of corporate influence, gaffes and goofs by leading TV pundits, and more. That's every Friday at 5:30 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, the Joint Office of Homeless Services overcounted the amount of unhoused people who got housing through their services, according to the county auditor. The security guard who shot and killed a man in a Lowe's parking lot in North Portland has been indicted for murder. And Oregon will introduce a digital vaccine card early next year. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 3rd, 2021. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Sam Bowman. The Joint Office of Homeless Services, or JOHS, may be overcounting its success stories by as much as 20%, according to the county auditor. The Joint Office of Homeless Services is a collaboration between the City of Portland and Multnomah County. It coordinates response to the homelessness crisis across the county. The county auditor, Jennifer McGuirk, wrote a memo Wednesday detailing how she found success data from the joint office to be overestimated. Instead of counting the date when someone gets placed in permanent housing, these data points were mixed in with data about when people started the process to get permanent housing. In the memo, McGuirk wrote, quote, "This is problematic because some who enter a housing program do not end up entering housing," end quote. McGuirk estimated the overcount to be about 22%. For 2019 and 2020, that amounts to 1,000 people a year counted as having gotten permanent housing that the auditor couldn't find record of them actually getting placed into. McGuirk found addresses that didn't exist or names missing in the data. The joint office responded to the claim of overcounting, saying they know their data is not the best, but that they are only overcounting by 10%. The audit comes at a critical time, since the joint office will be partly tasked with spending a $2.5 billion bond over the next 10 years that was passed by Metro voters in 2020. The security guard who shot and killed a man in a Lowe's parking lot in May was indicted on murder charges today. For more on the story, it's KBOO's Josh Salem.
A Multnomah County grand jury returned a murder indictment against a security guard charged with killing a customer outside a Lowe's Home Improvement Center in North Portland. Police say Logan Gimble, 28, shot Freddie Nelson, 49, as Nelson sat in his truck. Gimble was on patrol at the Delta Shopping Center. Gimble said the shooting was in self-defense. However, the grand jury returned indictments charging him with second-degree murder with a firearm, unlawful use of a firearm, reckless endangerment, and two counts of unlawful use of mace. Nelson's family has filed a $25 million wrongful death suit against Gimble and his employer, Cornerstone Security Group. Gimble was not certified to carry a firearm. He surrendered his unarmed private security certification in June, shortly after the shooting. At the time, the State Department of Public Safety Standards and Training was moving to revoke that certification for having a gun on the job, as well as using deadly force with a gun. According to the Nelson family's lawyer, Nelson went to Lowe's to buy remodeling materials. He parked in the lot and was gathering belongings while his wife walked to the garden center. Gimble pulled up and blocked the truck. He told Nelson he was under arrest, but Nelson stated the security guard didn't have the authority to arrest him. Gimble then walked in front of the truck, raised his gun, and ordered Nelson and his wife, who had returned from Lowe's, not to move. Shortly thereafter, he fired four shots, striking Nelson three times. Gimble was wearing a body camera during the incident. The Portland Police Bureau has the video footage. According to Cornerstone Security, Gimble had previous problems with Nelson. They added Nelson acted as if he was about to run Gimble over. Gimble warned him to stop, but Nelson continued right before the shooting. State Senator Floyd Prozanski, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said the case strengthens the need to review the de-escalation training private security personnel receive to obtain certification or licensure. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon will be testing a digital vaccine verification tool in spring 2022. Users will opt in digitally with their name, birth date, and email. It's modeled after similar digital tools in California and Washington. They've spent about $2 million on the effort, which will allow users to have a QR code to prove their vaccination status in lieu of a digital or paper CDC vaccination card. The Oregon Health Authority has stressed that using this digital vaccine verification tool is voluntary and no one has to participate if they don't want to. Officials hope it will help with businesses like bars and restaurants who may want to require vaccinations from their patrons. Workers won't have to match a driver's license with the too-big-to-fit-in-your-pocket vaccination card. Overdose deaths in the United States are at a high through the pandemic, but one potential solution is finally getting a proper test. New York City opened its first supervised consumption site this week. With more on what that looks like and what impact it may have, here's KBOO's Doug McVeigh.
The city of New York has become the first municipality in the United States to open officially sanctioned supervised consumption sites, also called overdose prevention centers. The office of New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio made the announcement early on the morning of Tuesday, November 30th. To learn more about supervised consumption sites, I spoke with a couple of experts.
Hi, I'm Haven Wheelock. I run the Drug User Health Services Program at Outside Inn in Portland, Oregon. I mean, when I read the news this morning, I cried. I know many of the tireless, amazing advocates that worked on this over decades, and it's really a life-saving intervention that is coming our way. I think this is an opportunity for all of us to really look at how to best save lives, and overdose prevention sites are one key tool that's worked internationally to help keep people alive in what is really a crushing overdose crisis in our country. I'm very, very, very excited.
Do you think the city of Portland should follow suit, and what would that mean?
I think all cities need to follow suit. I think in general, like we know, looking at international data from over 30 years, that overdose prevention sites reduce HIV, hepatitis C, overdose death, reduce crime, provide humanity and dignity to people who are using substances. And all jurisdictions, including Portland, really should have spaces like this for people to come, to get their needs met, to be treated with kindness, and to heal.
How do people follow the work that you do and that Outside In does on social media? And do you have a website?
Yeah, Outside In's got a website. It's outsidein.org, where all of our work is listed, as well as having an Instagram and a Facebook page.
Any closing thoughts for the listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people, like, acknowledging that we are in a crisis of overdose deaths. Over 100,000 people died of drug overdose in the last year. It's worse than we've ever seen it. Oregon's overdose death rate is above the national average in increase over the last year, and it's really time for us to come together and do something different. And we're all looking to New York to model what comes next.
That was Haven Wheelock, Syringe Services Coordinator for Outside In.
My name is Avi Elheved. I am a peer intern at a syringe access program, and I'm also a person who uses drugs and a member of the Portland Drug User Union, which is a citizen advocacy group formed by and for people with lived experience with substances that are marginalized and criminalized. We advocate for public health and civil liberties of people who use drugs, and for policy changes and the building of community spaces that reflect that. Well, my thoughts are that this is long overdue and that this is a very important foundational step in building an ecosystem of harm reduction and public health services for people who use substances. This obviously does not repair all of the damages done by drug prohibition, the war on drugs, different criminalizing approaches that have not worked and have really thrown fuel on the fire of the overdose crisis. But it is just a very important step. What it does is it allows some of our most vulnerable communities to form basically triage centers, is what I like to call them. Because in a better world, we would not need highly, highly medicalized spaces to prevent overdoses if we didn't have such a toxic illicit supply. But that is what we're facing. And safe consumption sites do a few critical things. First of all, around the world for the past, honestly, it's over a decade, it's over a couple decades that these have existed in different countries around the world. And there has not been a single fatal overdose reported at any of them. Of the overdoses that have occurred there, all of them have been successfully reversed. So in that regard, from a public health standpoint, they are very safe. They do serve their purpose of preventing overdoses. They also provide a bridge to wraparound services, basically on the same principle that syringe access programs or needle exchanges provide a jumping off point to various services. So people who come in have this space where they're given dignity and bodily autonomy. They can show up, they can do their substance that they're already choosing to do. Under medical supervision, they feel safe, they feel respected by the staff, and behavioral health research really shows that that kind of space where people feel that they have dignity and they feel that they have support, that is where people feel the most comfortable asking for follow-up resources, whether that's housing services, counseling, if people are ready for something like detox or treatment or any sort of other healthcare services. That really provides a platform for them to make self-effective changes and request resources and spaces like safe consumption sites and needle exchange programs, and basically any other harm reduction service, have very high rates of connecting people to those services. Not all people who use drugs have a problematic relationship with the drugs that they use, but for those who do, this is a great jumping off point into recovery services. It's also, if somebody needs access to any other basic mental or physical healthcare services, it's also an excellent bridge. So really this is going to be a space that serves people with a continuum of substance use related experiences and connects them to their basic needs.
That was Avi Elheved with the Portland Drug Users Union. We were discussing the City of New York's decision to open officially authorized supervised consumption sites. Reporting for KBOO News, I'm Doug McVeigh.
A new report from Amazon Watch and Stand Earth asserts half the oil produced in the Amazon is refined in California. Advocates for curbing climate change groups want Governor Gavin Newsom to put a stop to it. Suzanne Potter has more.
California-based facilities are refining half of all the oil drilled in the Amazon rainforests, according to a report released Thursday by the groups Amazon Watch and Stand.Earth. Now, organizations that fight climate change are calling on Governor Gavin Newsom to end oil imports from the Amazon region. Los Angeles City Councilmember Paul Koretz says California should not be a party to the destruction of a region that sequesters a huge amount of carbon and circulates 20% of the world's oxygen.
As the Amazon is being logged, burned, and drilled and converted to other land uses, we're losing more and more of it. And at some point, it could cause climate change to be impossible to reverse.
At the recent climate conference in Glasgow, Scotland, California joined the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, an organization committed to an oil-free future. On Earth Day this year, the governor committed to end fracking in the state by 2024 and all oil production by 2045. In October, Newsom proposed a 3,200-foot buffer zone for all new wells near residential neighborhoods. The oil industry claims these moves will cost the state jobs and tax revenue. The group Elected Officials to Protect America is circulating an online petition asking the governor to phase out oil production even faster and commit the state to 100% clean energy in all sectors. Dominic Frangillo, the group's executive director, says the state must defeat its oil addiction.
California can ramp down production, increase use of clean cars, phase out oil drilling locally, and aggressively invest in a transition to clean energy. We won't need that oil.
According to Greenpeace, the Amazon basin sequesters 100 billion metric tons of carbon, more than 10 times the amount of global emissions from fossil fuels. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $45,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with an overnight low of 38. And tomorrow, there will be scattered showers with a high of 52. Today in history, in 1901, President Teddy Roosevelt delivered a 20,000-word speech to Congress to curb the power of industry trusts. The quote of the day is from Scottish author Robert Louis Stevenson, who died on this day in 1894. He said, quote, "Don't judge each day by the harvest you reap, but by the seeds you plant." Navajo environmental advocate testifies about proposed EPA methane rules, and Haskell Indian Nations University women's basketball is back on the court. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous environmental advocates in New Mexico are closely following proposed methane rules that would restrict oil and gas emissions at well sites. Roz Brown has more.
Resident Kendra Pinto works as a Four Corners Indigenous Community Field Advocate for Earthworks and was one of several New Mexicans who testified this week when the EPA held 3 days of hearings to gather public input.
The decisions made in offices hundreds of miles away from the oil field have a direct impact on people. Those spaces must be considered. Do not waste any more time when change is needed now.
On Wednesday, a coalition of oil and natural gas businesses in New Mexico released a commission study showing state and local governments are more reliant than ever before on the industry to pay for basic public services, including public education. Some 200 educators responded to the report, calling on elected leaders to continue efforts to diversify the state's economy and reduce reliance on revenues from extraction. Pinto said the health of her community would be greatly improved if the new methane rules are adopted for oil and gas sites.
Due to the proximity of the sites near schools and residential areas, it is imperative that oil and gas sites are regulated with the full authority of the Clean Air Act and monitored thoroughly.
Under the Trump administration, the EPA rolled back limits on methane pollution from the oil and gas industry enacted by the Obama administration. President Joe Biden has since signed legislation to reinstate the 2016 safeguards. This is Roz Brown.
Haskell Indian Nations University women's basketball is back on the court, returning to competition in a somewhat normal setting due to COVID-19. The Kansas team played a unique away game Thursday to take on a new opponent in a different division. Rhonda Lavaldo reports.
In the first meeting ever between Division I University of Missouri, Kansas City, and Haskell women's basketball team, who plays in the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics, the score might have told one story, but the return to live in-person sports is back. Haskell guard Tiana Gullery says she was ready for this season since missing out last year.
This is my senior year, and we have a new team this year. We have a new coach, so it's just exciting overall. We're kind of just at that point in the season where we're trying to put all the pieces together, and we're just trying to, you know, work together as a team and just keep moving forward as we go into conference.
Haskell coach Adam Strom says they haven't had consecutive practices due to COVID protocols and not a lot of time off between games, but he says the return is great with his team.
These people don't represent Lawrence. They don't represent Haskell Indian Nations University. I tell them they represent something more, and that's the Native American indigenous community throughout Indian country. And I think that means a lot. And the score is not indicative of what we're about and who we represent. So, you know, we recruit from a small pool of Native American college athletes, you know, being, a small pool of people. And UMKC has a luxury of, recruiting all ethnicities. And no excuses. They're a solid team, great team. But the point is, I'm extremely proud of my ladies in their conduct.
As the nation deals with the COVID-19 pandemic, athletes are getting their chance again to do what they are passionate about. Haskell women took the 95-38 loss, as Gullery stated, a way to improve for the rest of the season. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
California Assemblymember James Ramos is hosting a roundtable and visit Friday at California Indian Nations College in Palm Desert. The tribal college is working to gain federal accreditation and become one of the 30 such tribal higher education institutions in the U.S. California, which has a high Native American population, does not currently have a tribal college. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The U.S. House passes a stopgap government spending bill, and the Omicron variant makes its way to Minnesota. With these stories and others, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Madam Speaker, pursuant to House Resolution 829, I call up the bill H.R. 6119 and ask for its immediate consideration in the House.
Connecticut Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro called the question as the House voted to fund the government through February 18th to avert a Friday government shutdown. Only one Republican, Illinois Representative Adam Kinzinger, supported the bill, which now heads to the Senate. The Omicron variant has been detected in a vaccinated Minnesota resident, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
The person's symptoms have resolved. The person spoke with the Minnesota Public Health Department investigators and reported traveling to New York City and attending the Anime New York City 2021 convention at the Javits Center.
The Minnesota case comes one day after the CDC confirmed the United States' first known case of the variant. Vice President Kamala Harris's chief spokesperson and senior advisor, Simone Sanders, has announced her departure from the administration, the second exit among Harris's communications staff in recent weeks. In North Carolina Thursday, Harris praised the state's Democratic lawmakers for their help passing the infrastructure law.
Because of their work, because of our work together, America is moving again. Because ultimately, that's what infrastructure is all about. Getting people moving.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke about the importance of federal abortion care protections a day after all six conservative Supreme Court justices indicated they would uphold Mississippi's current law, banning abortion after 15 weeks.
Codification of Roe is the strongest weapon that we have to blunt these restrictive anti-woman state laws. Now, we don't know what the decision will be from the court.
The court is expected to issue a decision in June. The Department of Homeland Security says it's preparing to revive the Migrant Protection Protocols policy, more commonly known as the Remain in Mexico policy, which requires many migrants seeking asylum to stay in Mexico while awaiting immigration hearings. The Biden administration has tried multiple times to strike down the policy, but in August, a federal judge in Texas ordered the program restored. Finally, President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden lit the national Christmas tree in the South Lawn of the White House Thursday evening, continuing a tradition begun in 1923.
For the evergreen tree reminds us that even in the coldest, darkest days of winter, that life and abundance will return. It's a bright beacon of hope that reminds us of the promise we find in Scripture.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Over the next couple weeks, folks will be clicking the purchase button as they order holiday gifts online. Fraud experts say it's important this time of year to slow down and research before making holiday purchases. Mike Moen reports from North Dakota.
Fraud experts say scammers still are finding ways to exploit consumers. They urge the public to avoid abrupt transactions that come with little research. Amy Nossiger is director of fraud victim support at AARP. She says fake social media ads are a big concern this year. She says as people quickly scroll through online ads, they might not do enough vetting to make sure the company behind a post is real. She adds supply chain issues could prompt people to bypass trusted companies through internet searches.
And they're finding these websites that look legitimate, but they're not. So again, take the name of the company, put it in a search engine, and do your research.
When entering the unknown company's name, she suggests typing the words review, scam, and complaints to see what pops up. Another common scam right now is getting a message disguised as a warning from well-known delivery companies indicating something went wrong with a shipment to your address. Experts say they often include harmful links. Carol Grossman of the North Dakota Attorney General's Office says they continue to field calls for a variety of scams, including online romance situations where someone loses their money to the person they connected with. He worries people might be more vulnerable to those scenarios right now.
When you're lonely at the holidays, might be the time you decide to engage with someone over the internet, and they can be very convincing, and they will have a myriad of reasons why they need money.
Nofziger adds that you should never feel ashamed about falling victim to a scam and that taking immediate action is the best approach.
These are good criminals that are targeting you to steal your money. You should be mad. You should be empowered to report it.
Mike Moen, Prairie News Service.
A new report finds since the beginning of the pandemic, complaints against U.S. airlines have more than quadrupled. Most of the grievances are over fare refunds, canceled or delayed flights, and poor customer service. Mark Richardson has more from Arizona.
A new report shows, despite getting billions of dollars from the federal government under the American Rescue Plan, many airlines continue to interrupt travelers' plans with cancellations and are slow to issue refunds. When the pandemic hit in early 2020, air travel in the U.S. and across the world almost completely stopped. But in recent months, as the airlines begin to add flights, customers are complaining of multiple canceled and delayed flights, denied refunds, and customer service failures. Diane Brown heads the Arizona PERG Education Fund, which issued the report. She calls it outrageous that the airlines took taxpayer funds but refused to deal fairly with their customers.
The airline industry has been short-staffed, and that has caused consumers to have flight cancellations that often have a rippling effect.
Airlines have said their industry was gut-punched by the pandemic and that they're working to get back on track. They blamed air traffic control, inclement weather, computer outages, and a lack of available flight crews for stranding or delaying passengers. And consumers have not been shy about telling the U.S. Department of Transportation just how unhappy they are. Between February 2020 and August 2021, Brown says the number of complaints about airline service increased 460%, and refunds have been hard to come by.
Consumers often prefer to just get their money back, to save it for another trip versus having to use the funds by a certain period of time.
Brown says travelers need to know their rights and alternatives.
consumers do have options when it comes to which airline they choose, which airport they may lay over in, and their ability to contact policymakers and urge better protection.
The report, Not First Class, Flyer Complaints Soar, is online at azpergedfund.org. I'm Mark Richardson for Arizona News Connection.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Doug McVeigh. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Nadia Ramlagan, Mark Richardson, Mike Moen, Suzanne Potter, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. That could be you. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $45,000 by December 31st. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Have a great night. Counterspin is next.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson.